Life as a millennial varies from state to state, but in some states, the millennial generation is faring better. New research out gives us a state-by-state barometer on where it's best to live if you're a millennial. We're talking about it on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is in the house. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us this morning from WPR studio in Eau Claire. Hi there, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a persistent personal finance question for Kevin to consider, call it in, 800-642-1234. You can send it our way to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, Kevin, several recent studies have shown that many young adults may be better off shunning the bright lights of the big cities, apparently.
Yes, and maybe even that big paycheck, especially if that's not the most important factor in their lives. You remember, Kate, a few months ago we talked about a WalletHub survey that said Wisconsin and other Midwest states typically do pretty well when talking about affordability, quality of life, and balance. And in that study, WalletHub said Wisconsin was the 11th best state to raise kids and fourth in affordability.
What are some of the other reports out there?
Another one from the good people at WalletHub took a look at what was best for millennials, and they used metrics such as affordability, education and health, economic health of the area. And this was pretty interesting. Civic engagement, the percentage of millennials who voted and volunteered. The best was D.C., District of Columbia, North Dakota, and Minnesota. The worst three states were Mississippi, West Virginia, and New Mexico. But Wisconsin did sixth in the study what's the best state for millennials in which to live. And the most of the Midwestern states did pretty well. Iowa was fifth, Illinois 18th, Michigan all the way down at 27th. And we also have found a study that discussed the work-life balance. Now, this was more geared towards small business owners, but this one was interesting because you need business owners to start businesses before they can hire more people. And Wisconsin usually hasn't done as well in getting small businesses going and creating an environment that small businesses can start up compared to other states nearby. And that was shown from Fit Small Business website at fitsmallbusiness.com. Wisconsin scored 18th in work-life balance for small business owners. Minnesota was number one, and Iowa, Nebraska, North and South Dakota, Montana, Colorado all scored in the top 10 for work-life balance of small business owners.
So strong showing all around for the heartland. What about the notion, though, that there's not as much for younger adults to do in smaller Midwestern communities?
Yeah, that's probably a sign, Kate. You know, you have children, I have children. If you can't find anything to do in your community, just have kids.
That'll
take up all the extra free time you have, all the extra money you have. You really will have no other energy to go out to dinner, go to a movie, or
true,
anything like that.
So all just, of the above.
Right, just have kids, yeah. There was actually a Smart Asset, another website, did a study of communities in population 65,000 to 99,000, and they looked at it more from a perspective of what there was to do in communities of this size: entertainment, bars, income inequality, the commute, etc. And Wisconsin small cities did very well. Oshkosh was in the top 5. Eau Claire, Wisconsin, was in the top 14, and other Midwest communities did very well in the top 10. Livonia, Michigan, Sioux City, Iowa, and Duluth, Minnesota were all there as well.
Well, boil this down for us, Kevin. What can we take away from all of these metrics?
You know, Kate, in a month or so, millions of young adults are going to graduate from college or grad school, and they're hopefully going to have job offers, and they're going to be able to choose to live almost anywhere they want. And big cities are fun while you're young, but they're very difficult to grow old in, especially now with the real estate market being what it is, the competition for all these places, trying to get into private schools, trying to purchase a place that has a desirable public school district. So while you're young, if you want to go live in the big city and be broke, that's fantastic. But if you have a chance to move, whether it's due to a new job or a new career, perhaps your partner is picking up stakes and moving, and there's no temporary restraining order, so you can follow him or her where he or she is going, and think of it, this next move might be where you stay for the next 10 to 20 to 30 years, especially if you do choose to have children, because it is tougher to look at your sweet 10-year-old and say, I know you love your school and your teacher and your classmates and your friends. We're moving across the country because I got to $5,000 bump in salary. So don't just look at the salary and the paycheck. Consider time and cost of living. A lot of things that people really like about smaller areas is the commute, the fact that they can get wherever they need to go in about 15 or 20 minutes and less if it's not during rush hour. So you're better off living cheaply in the cheapest place you can possibly afford. And traveling. We've had several stories where younger adults have said, you know, I went to live in Duluth, but once a month I drive down to the Twin Cities and I book a hotel room down there and I go out to nice restaurants and bars and catch a show down there. And
then
I go
back. The city fix.
The city fix. Right. I like that. Have you trademarked that yet? Because if you haven't, I'm going to. Yeah. Try to take advantage of those by traveling there, because one of the dirty little secrets of people, younger adults especially, who live in these larger cities is they really can't afford to go out that much because of the cost of living, because of the amount of work that they have to do. They're really not taking advantage of these amenities like we might think they are.
Well, speaking of living cheaply, you have an announcement regarding next week's membership drive show.
Yes, Kate. Next week is a membership drive, and we are going to be offering a classic On Your Money mini money booklet. It's called 20 Money Moves. Now, this is the basics that just about everybody can grab something from that they're not doing. You know, in my grown-up job during the day, I'm a financial planner, and people pay me a lot of money to sit down with me and talk about their finances, go through a financial plan, projections, etc. And I took a lot of what I do during those meetings and boiled it down to 20 money moves. We cover things like freezing your credit report, how to figure out where your next dollar should go, how to figure out if you're ready to retire. And it's in a very small, simple booklet, and it's good for young adults. It's also good for older adults. And if you pledge during On Your Money next week, any dollar amount whatsoever, you will get your copy of the On Your Money Mini Money Booklet, 20 Money Moves, again during next week's shows.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And with that said, if you have a personal finance question that's on your mind, ask it. 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can send it by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, a listener named Carol says, we gave my son a $16,000 gift of stock. How does he pay taxes on it? For some reason, we thought it was tax-free.
For some reason, right. Just we're not really sure why. Yeah, it actually is tax-free to him. However, there is such a thing as the gift tax, which may come into play. Whenever you give more than, for 2017, the figure was $14,000 to any other single individual, or $15,000 for 2018 and beyond, per person per year. When you exceed that amount in the form of a gift, there may be gift taxes owed by you, the giver, not the recipient.
Well, is there any way around that gift tax?
Yeah, right. Per person is the key factor here. And in the Carol says, we gave my son, so I assume this is two parents. And if that's the case, they can actually each give $14,000 in value to her son of any cash, securities, whatever, without incurring any gift tax whatsoever. So in 2018, it's $15,000 to $30,000 can be given without a gift tax. And even if that dollar amount is exceeded, you can still avoid the gift tax by using what's known as the lifetime gift exemption. You file a gift tax return the following year saying, I gave $100,000 to some lucky person and I don't want to pay any gift taxes on it. So I'm using a portion of my exemption to cover that, and then therefore I don't owe any gift taxes.
Are there any other tax issues that Carol and her son should consider?
Yes, the cost basis of this security in this particular case stays with the son, the recipient. So if and when he sells the security, he has the cost basis that Carol and her husband, we assume, had on the security. So when he sells it, he may still owe a capital gains tax. Now, the nice way to do this is when someone who has, first of all, enough money to give away in this form but second of all, is also likely to be in a higher tax bracket. So rather than selling it and giving the money to the family member in the lower tax bracket, you pass the securities on to the son sells it, and if he's in a lower income bracket, which most younger people are, then he can sell it and probably pay 0% in long-term capital gains on the profit.
And if you have a question, a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, you can join us at 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, a question coming in. Could I pay non-IRA investment fees using IRA funds without this being characterized as an income distribution by the IRS?
Yes. Well, it's if you're paying for non-IRA investment fees, you're just pulling it out of savings. And this is from when we talked about something last week, where if you pull money out of an IRA to pay investment management fees for your investment advisor, usually about 1% a year, the fee can be tax-free. So something you'd otherwise pay maybe 10 to 40% on taxes on, it's actually tax-free, so it's a good idea to do it. But if you pull it out from just your normal savings, then there would be no taxation on it anyway, regardless of what you choose to do with the money.
You're with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and you can join in with your financial question, 800-642-1234. Email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, the IRS recently clarified the rules for homeowners who want to borrow against the equity in their home. We'll get an update in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Where money questions are front and center. You're with us for another installment of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. As the April tax season wraps up, we're talking about home equity loans. The new tax law passed by Congress and signed by President Trump changed the rules on when the interest paid on home equity loans can be deducted. We'll get some insights later on, along with your questions at 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Helen joining us from Madison. Hi there, Helen.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I have a question about I-bonds. First of all, I have some I purchased 10 and 15 years ago, and I'm wondering what the current interest rate is, and also how can I access or find out what they're worth now. I am not able to use the internet because it's too difficult to manage.
Yeah, Helen, I'm running into the same problem as you on the internet, so I'm about ready to swear it off myself. So, yeah, the Series I savings bonds are available for people who are comfortable with the internet. You can get information on them at treasurydirect.gov. And the I stands for inflation. What happens is that you purchase the bond, and then every 6 months there's a new interest rate set, and it can be as little as nothing or maybe up to 4 or 5%, but it's adjusted kind of retroactively with the current consumer price index. And there's a new interest rate that's coming out on May 1st. Right now, the current interest rate is 2.58% for Series I savings bonds, and that's for new purchases. And it's actually, there's two components. There's a fixed interest rate, and then there's a variable one. The fixed one on new purchases of Series I savings bonds is just 0.1%. And then the variable one is kind of on top of that one. So you always get at least 0.1% if you purchase the bond right now. And then you'll get an additional 2.48% for the 6 months ending May 1st. So it's a very attractive investment for someone who likes safety and liquidity. And the interest can be either declared on a year-to-year basis, or you can defer declaring it on your taxes and then just pay taxes on the interest when you cash the bonds in. Now, the bonds are 30-year maturity. It's tough to get out of them within the first 12 months of purchasing them, but within the first 5 years of the purchase, there's only a 3-month penalty of interest for early withdrawal, and after 5 years, there's no penalty at all to take it out. You can only purchase about $10,000 of face value per person each calendar year, but it's a nice thing to do is just sock some money aside there and say, well, this is better than a checking account. The interest is exempt from state taxes, and at 2.58%, that's a pretty competitive interest rate for something this safe. Helen, you've brought up actually one of the issues of these is you can generally only purchase them online right now, and they're very difficult to manage if you don't have a comfort level with the internet. What I would suggest you do, Helen, is have you contacted your bank or your credit union?
I called the bank and asked if they would cash them in, and they said yes.
Oh, okay, great. Are you okay with bringing them down there?
Yes, I can do that.
Okay. If you need the money and they're willing to do that, that's good, because not every bank or credit union is willing to do this. So just I would feel very comfortable bringing it down there and having them handle it for you. And usually they'll give you all the paperwork that you need for tax reasons, et cetera. They have access to the system. You'll probably have to sign a couple forms. But, no, I would definitely take advantage of the offer if you're looking to cash those in.
Helen, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Mike now, joining us from Fond du Lac. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, okay, hi. Yeah, I'm retired, and I sold my home of 16 years to pay cash for another home so I wouldn't have payments. And it found out that the small town that we moved into did not have the health facilities that my wife needs for her kidney issues. So we have to move back into the big city. What I was wondering was, because I haven't been in the home for even a year, and I'm going to use the money to buy another home, am I going to be charged some type of tax because I didn't live in the home long enough?
Actually, if you're selling the house for medical or health reasons, if you document them with a letter from the physician, that should allow you to avoid the capital gains from it, but just keep it with your personal records, et cetera, for it. Now, normally, it has to be your primary residence for 2 out of the last 5 years to qualify for the capital gains exclusion, which is usually $250,000 for singles and $500,000 for married couples filing jointly. But if you are doing it specifically for healthcare reasons, Mike, I think you should be able to avoid it. Just out of curiosity, what kind of gain are you looking at on the house?
Well, there really hasn't been any kind of gains, because the profit that I got from selling the home of 16 years, I took every penny to pay cash for the second home, and I'll actually be having to add money to that price that I got for that home to buy another home, because the area I'm going back into, the homes are more expensive.
Okay, yeah, no, I don't think you should have any capital gains tax liability regardless, because it's not a roll-up situation. If your previous place was your primary residence for 2 out of the last 5 years and you had $500,000 or less of gains on it, then there's no taxation on it. And then this new one just started a new clock for you, so you shouldn't have any gains liability at all on it.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. Good luck with that move. Kevin, another email coming in here. My husband and I did the smart move of co-signing on a student loan, and the godchild is now dropped out of school, does not have a good enough job to pay on the loan. So can they write this off their taxes in any way, shape, or form?
The good news, bad news. Normally, people who are in this situation come back on a student loan. They can take the deduct the interest. It's potentially tax deductible anyway. The bad news is the person has to be a dependent. So you have to be legally obligated to pay the loan, meaning it has to be kind of in a default situation, or you have to have actual responsibility for it, not just helping the person out. And the person has to be a dependent. So it sounds like if it's a godchild in this situation, the person is not a dependent, and therefore for. They will still have to pay the loan interest, but don't have a chance to deduct it. It's all good. No good deed goes unpunished. Maybe is that the operable phrase here? And remember that if you do co-sign a loan, I think it's a great idea to co-sign loans as long as you assume that you are going to become responsible for those payments at some point. And if you can still co-sign that loan, then great, go ahead and do it, and then be pleasantly surprised if eventually it doesn't come back to you.
Kevin McKinley is with us on this edition of On Your Money. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, taking your personal finance questions at 800-642-1234. Email them to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, a change to the tax laws may reduce the benefit of borrowing against your home equity. What gives?
Well, there's some new rules, Kate, for how you can deduct the interest paid on mortgages, on home equity loans, and home equity lines of credit. Three tools that we're very big fans of if used responsibly.
And so what are the rules? Lay them out for us.
The interest is only tax deductible after January. It's actually December 15th, but January, starting of the 2018 tax year. If you use the loan to acquire, build, or substantially remodel real estate. So in other words, you can't just use a home equity line of credit or home equity loan to pay for a trip, and you can't use a mortgage cash out to, say, pay for college or something like that, for other purposes like that, and still deduct the interest. You can still use them, the money, however you want. You just can't use the interest cost as a tax deduction.
So how will homeowners be impacted by this change?
Well, for most homeowners, I mean, very few people, Mike, a previous caller notwithstanding, do have to borrow regardless. So you do have to take out a mortgage for it. And it's usually a good idea to do that because most people, even if they're fortunate enough to have enough cash to pay for a house outright, oftentimes they don't have a whole lot of other money, and therefore they become cash poor and house rich. So it's usually a good idea to have the mortgage. And because this is a qualified use, they will be able to deduct the interest if they qualify for it. And the problem is, though, is that you need to take the interest plus your other deductions to get to a figure that exceeds the new standard deduction. So it's not going to matter if you don't have enough deductions to equal $12,000 for single filers or $24,000 for married couples filing jointly. Otherwise, you're just going to be better off taking the standard deduction, and there won't matter to you whether you can deduct the interest on your mortgage or not.
Should this discourage homeowners then from using mortgages and home equity loans?
No, it's still an extremely low-cost source of funds, especially for big purchases and big projects. The fact that you can't deduct the interest is disappointing for some people, but it won't affect a huge number of borrowers. You should still get a new 30-year fixed-rate mortgage for 80% of the value if you are purchasing a home. And if you're looking to make a big purchase going forward on something else, or you think you're going to run into financial problems, you should at least think about getting a new mortgage or a home equity line of credit. I love home equity lines of credit just as an insurance policy for homeowners to have established so that they can tap that whenever they need it in an emergency without having to go through the application process. And you should usually get a home equity line of credit for as much as the lender will allow, even if it's a few hundred dollars to set up or maybe $100 to keep it open during the year. Please get that. If you are a homeowner and you have home equity established, get a home equity line of credit. And home equity loans, now this is where you just have a fixed rate loan that is over a fixed period of time, say 10 years or so. Those are a good idea to use if you don't have a lot of cash, but you are doing some kind of home improvement. Let's say you are redoing a bathroom and the kitchen. Home equity loan is usually easier to get than a mortgage, and it has lesser cost than the mortgage has. So you can just get the loan out and then pay that out over 10 years' time again. The bad news is that would, in a case, be a chance where you could deduct the interest because you are substantially remodeling the home. But most people won't qualify for that anyway because their standard deduction will exceed their itemized deductions.
Interestingly, along this line, Kevin, that our lender had us sign on the dotted line for that home equity line of credit right at closing yesterday.
Wow.
Yeah.
Finally listening to our advice.
Let's go back to the phones now with Arlene joining us from Burlington. Hi, Arlene.
Good morning. morning. Kevin, love your show. Thank you for answering one of my long questions. We opened brokerage accounts for each of our grandchildren years ago and routinely transfer some of our stock into their accounts. We thought it was in our names and their names so that they would be at our tax rate for capital gains when they sell it for college. We recently found out that it isn't under their parents, who are high-income earners at this age, and we're trying to figure out how to get it out of their parents, or how long do they wait before they sell the stock when they're going to college so that it doesn't go on to their parents' tax rate capital gain.
Right. Arlene, are these accounts to which you are referring, do they use the children's Social Security numbers, or do they use their parents'?
No, they use the children's.
Okay. Then technically, the rules surrounding income and capital gains taxation for minor children, I assume these kids are under 18, correct?
Correct.
Okay. The rules surrounding this are really tricky, and the IRS is trying to discourage families from transferring highly appreciated assets into children's names and then selling it and then not paying any taxes or not paying much. So there's a small amount of income that can be earned by the children or capital gains that they can receive, and it's taxed at a lower rate. But anything above that then becomes taxable. And are these actual stocks, Arlene, or are they stock mutual funds?
Yes. No, they are stocks.
They're stocks. Okay. Well, a couple things that you might want to do is, do you actually need this money, or is this just one potential source of several that you can use to pay for the kids' college?
No, it's to routinely get rid of some of our stock and give it to them.
Okay. So technically, the kids don't absolutely need the proceeds right now to pay for college, right?
No.
You mean I'm correct? You don't need the money for it?
Okay. Need the money right now.
What I would do then is, if they don't need the money, I would wait until they reach adulthood. And they'll probably, that's can be usually 18 to 21, depending on the state in which they reside. And then once they reach adulthood, then the kiddie tax, as it's called, doesn't apply anymore. And it's only upon their capital gains. So then they could probably incur about $50,000 to $100,000 of long-term capital gains before they would have a significant tax hit on that. And so what I would do is wait until they reach the age of majority and then have them sell the securities at that particular point. Now, keep in mind that that if they do that, you're obviously taking market risk with the security as well between now and that time. So if it's something where they really need the money, I would say just bite the bullet, sell it, pay the kiddie tax on it, but at least try to wait until they are the age of majority. Also understand, Arlene, if the kids are going to apply for any need-based financial aid when they're in college, if and when they sell securities in their name, that could disqualify for them for other need-based financial aid that the school might award or federal grants that they might qualify for. So be careful in the timing of that as well. Sometimes the tax savings are more than offset by lost need-based financial aid.
Arlene, thanks so much for calling and looking out for those grandkids. Let's go to James now, joining us from Columbus. Hi, James.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. What's the question?
His question.
I think that's by my parents. they are they're in their late 60s and just wondering about smarter ways to distribute assets to their four kids, either property or other assets. And, other than the annual gift amount, I didn't really have much of an answer for them. So wondering, the question came up about setting up trusts and some of the benefits of doing that, or ways to go about that for property or other suggestions. Kind of an open-ended question, I realize, but.
Well, I'll give you an open-ended answer then, James. Thanks for asking. And there are a few different aspects to this. One is people set up a trust to say, well, I'm going to gift highly appreciated assets to this trust, and then hopefully or large amounts to it, and if it's an irrevocable trust and we pass away, we can avoid estate taxes on it. Well, the estate tax exemption right now is, $11 million or something per person, and a married couple is $22 million. And so hardly any estates are going to be taxed under today's law. So that part isn't a reason of why I would put the put the assets into a trust. Another one is people say, well, if I stick money in the trust, then I can qualify for public assistance if I should go into the nursing home. And technically that's possible to do, but it's kind of like a have your cake and eat it too kind of proposition. It's very difficult to have access to the money, but then not have it be considered as part of the pool of assets when awarding public assistance for nursing home care. And it's really something that people generally don't go to nursing home. When they do, they don't stay there for very long. And oftentimes between the assets they already have and Social Security checks coming in and real estate, it's really not a huge financial dent to their situation. There's definitely stories out there where it is, but those stories are relatively rare. The third reason to set up a trust, and this is in my opinion, the best reason to do so, is it establishes kind of an ownership pathway or decision-making process for the assets while your folks are still alive and able to make the decision of how they'd want it done. And you can set up a revocable trust where the parents would place the assets in the trust, and then if something should happen to them where they are alive but unable to manage their own affairs, a pre-appointed trustee can step in and say, okay, I'll handle things for you guys because you're just not in a position to do so. Then once you pass away, usually the trust is distributed according to the beneficiaries. Your first step to doing this, James, is to talk with your parents, see if you have a local attorney who is skilled in estate planning and has that as a specialty. If not, you probably have to take them to a bigger area to find someone who is specializes in that particular area of it. And then they should actually go back and review it about every 5 years or so, because oftentimes the laws will change, or more likely the family situation changes. Somebody gets married, somebody gets divorced, somebody has a kid, one of the adult children maybe isn't doing so well, and they want to make sure that that person doesn't get money that may otherwise harm them even further. And so about every 5 years, and you can expect to spend probably $1,000 to $3,000 from start to finish to get this established in the first place, and then maybe another $1,000 to $2,000 every few years or so just to make sure it's updated. And there's an old axiom, I'm guessing your parents aren't going to enjoy paying this money, but the old axiom is you can pay a lawyer a little bit of money now or a lot later. So if they pay a little now, it's kind of insurance that they can avoid having to pay the attorney a lot later to clean up a mess.
Well, James, we appreciate that Longview question. You're listening to On Your Money, and your go-to financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is here. He's member of McKinley Money LLC, and your questions are in the mix at 800-642-1234. Email your personal finance question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Later this hour, how to make a smart battery purchase when breathing new life into your iPhone. We'll be back in a moment for more here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Apple recently announced that it was intentionally slowing down older iPhone models in order to preserve battery life. My good old iPhone 5 is saying, what did I do to deserve this? We've come so far together. Kevin McKinley will have insights on battery replacement purchases later on. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Ship off your email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Dara, who has been waiting in Kenosha. Hi, Dara.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So my question is, I'm not really savvy with the market at all. But I have a 401k and a 403b, both from previous jobs that I can't contribute to. And so I don't know if I'm supposed to roll them over into one thing that I can start contributing to, and that's a better idea. I'm looking for long-term effects for retirement. Or do I leave them sit there, continue to accrue some money, and open up something different with a current job?
Sure. Dara, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 38.
Okay, great. I'd just as soon have you leave those accounts there if you can't roll them into your new plan. And here's why. There is a very arcane rule that allows people who have been separated from service from their previous employer to pull money out of 401ks and 403bs and not having to pay the penalty, the 10% penalty on it, even if they are under 59 and a half. And if you move that in, those into an IRA, you could lose that option. So if you have a job now and you just want to have them in one account, I would probably check with your current employer and see if it's possible to move them in there. You can contribute to your current employer's plan and still leave those other accounts there if you want. It's not, the ability to contribute is not predicated upon having all those money in one place, the money in one place. It might make it easier for you to manage, and it also might save you a little bit on fees, although usually most 403Bs and 401Ks are scaled pretty well so that the fees are relatively low to keep it in there. You can move it into your own self-directed IRA as well. Again, you lose some of the advantages of keeping it into the 403B and 401K for pulling it out in an emergency down the road. But the good news is that you then get to do whatever you want with the money. If you leave it in the 403B or the 401K, you're usually limited to about maybe 8 to 12 different investment options from a menu. Usually those are pretty good options, but it's not everything. There are thousands and thousands of things you can invest in outside of the 403B or 401K. So you don't have to do it, but you can do it, and especially it might be a good idea to do it if you can roll them into your current employer's 401K. Does your current employer there have a 401K?
So you think, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So do you think it's a good idea to just roll it over, if I can, both of those into my current job 401k option, or you thought it was a better idea to leave those alone and just open up my, keep my separate 401k from my present employer?
You don't have to. It's up to you. But if it were me, what I would do is, if your current employer allows it, I would move them into your current 401k just so it's easier to manage for it. What I probably wouldn't do in your situation is move it into your own IRA, which is a separate kind of jar. All these transactions are tax-free or tax-deferred, if you will, because if you move it from one custodian to another, it's not taxable to you as long as you don't take possession of the funds. But it would probably be easier to manage if you can move it all into one account. So I probably wouldn't move it into an IRA yet until you're actually retired. For the time being, it's probably best to just move it into your current employer's plan.
Are there any costs associated with that rollover?
That's a good question, Kate. Usually not, and especially if it's going from one 401k to another. Sometimes the previous custodian will put in like a $50 or $100 transfer closing fee for it. That's the nature of the business. Hopefully, Dara has enough money where that won't wipe out the account, and so there'll still be something there to move over. But that's also something that you should check, Dara, before deciding to make that transfer.
Dara, thanks. Let's move on to Steve in Wausau. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I heard a formula many years ago. Don't know where I heard it. But when a couple about the same age, getting closer to retirement, and they're going to draw their retirements, obviously they're not going to be paying Social Security normally, or Medicare or anything on that money coming in. So how much is that really worth to them? Like if, say, they were both getting $2,000 on Social Security, that'd be $48,000 a year. What would you have to make on the outside to bring that kind of money in?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of levers in there going on, but usually the employee portion of Social Security is right now 7.65% of income under about $120,000 or so. So if you pulled in $48,000 or so in the real world, I'm guessing about $3,500, give or take, would go towards Social Security, and then another 2.9% or 1.45% for the employee's share for Medicare taxes as well. So you can figure about 9% for most lower to middle income workers would be going towards Social Security and Medicare taxes otherwise.
Does that make sense there?
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Let's move on to Dennis now in Janesville. Hi there, Dennis.
Hi there. Quick question. Actually, two quick questions. One is, I'm the trustee of my father's estate. He's passed away, and we are looking to sell his home, which is part of the trust, obviously. And in the sale of that home, we believe it will probably sell for less than the fair market value, so we would assume it would be a loss. But we want to take the proceeds of that home and divide it amongst the siblings per the trust. Is that money taxable per sibling, or how does that work? That's question number one. Mm-hmm. Question number two, very simple. In terms of a pension, is it better to take it as a lump sum, or is it better to take it as an annuity? And is that annuity guaranteed typically? This is a Fortune 500 company. Mm-hmm. Those are my two questions.
Thank well, Dennis, first of all, condolences on the loss of your father. Second of all, condolences on having to serve as the trustee of the estate. That's usually a thankless job. It's unlikely that that the siblings will pay any taxes on the sales proceeds of the house unless the trust was set up in a way that would make any income pulled out of it taxable. And usually, as I mentioned earlier, these kinds of things are set up in a revocable living trust. And if that is indeed the case, it's unlikely there'll be any taxation on it whatsoever. Estate taxes, income taxes, nothing for it. Your second question is simple, but it's not easy. Well, I shouldn't say that. If you're trying to decide between taking a pension lump sum or annuitizing it and taking monthly checks, you have to know how long you are going to be around and how long the pension is going to be around. And many pensions right now are in better shape than they have been because of the investment markets increasing in asset prices over the last decade or so. But several of them are still below full funding. And they're using future investment returns of anywhere from 6 to 8% that says that they're funding. That's kind of like getting in your car and going to drive someplace that's an hour away and saying, well, we will get there. If it's 60 miles away, we'll get there in 45 minutes or whatever, as long as we drive at least 90 miles per hour. That may be possible to do, but it's unlikely. And you're taking on some dangers trying to achieve that high rate of speed. It's the same thing with pensions. When they use 6 or 7 or 8% for future returns, they're probably taking on a lot of risk to achieve those returns, which makes it even less likely that they'll actually be there. So it really comes down to the old phrase, Dennis, about do you want a bird in the hand, which is the lump sum, or do you want two in the bush, which is the monthly checks every single month? And if you have lots of other assets other than the pension, you might want to take that bet that you and the pension are going to be around a long time and take in enough to offset what you could have done on your own with the lump sum. But if this is a significant portion of your net worth and you just want to have it there so you can not only see it, but invest it however you want and spend it however you want, taking the lump sum is the way that most people go.
Dennis, good luck, and thanks for those couple questions. You're with us for On Your Money, and Kevin McKinley is here giving us insights. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. There's still time for you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can send your personal finance question along to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. My mama told me. Yes, certain iPhone owners like myself may have been experiencing some issues recently, but help is on the way, apparently, Kevin.
Yes, it is. this will affect quite a few people. It sounds like you and me both. I'm sorry, Kate. Did you say you have the iPhone 5?
I'm a blast from the past, Kevin McKinley. I just don't see how people can keep so much money in their pocket and not be concerned about it.
Yeah, you're more of a vintage person. You're kind of cool.
Vintage.
You're a retro.
I love that. Right,
throwback.
Yes. Thanks for those words. Appreciate
it. Well, it is going to affect quite a few people. There are 270 million smartphone owners in the U.S., and the iPhone share is high, but it has fallen a little bit recently as people have moved on to Android-based phones. Still, 40% of smartphone users have iPhones, and a good chunk of those have iPhone 6s and 7s. I don't mean to denigrate your choice, Kate. So that means that this battery issue could affect tens of millions of Americans right now. And as you mentioned, several of these users have noticed that their batteries go down faster or their phones have been moving slower, operating more slowly than they would like. And even both instances have occurred, and that has caused Apple to come out and admit that there is a problem with these phones' batteries.
And so what problem is that?
Well, Apple says that every time you recharge your phone, like all other phones, the lithium ion battery degrades just a little bit, meaning it can't quite fill up as much as it did for the previous charge for it. And then it will not only need to be recharged sooner, but it's more likely to crash. And to try to prevent this, Apple put into the iOS system that it would throttle use, meaning it would work more slowly so it wouldn't use as much battery power, and then you wouldn't have to make less recharges. But several people noticed that the phone was a lot slower than they would like it to be.
So is there anything us in this camp can do to fix our phones that's not super costly?
Yes. There's a new iOS, new system version, 11.3, that you probably got a notification on that said, hey, you need to update this, and if you don't press this button and that button, we're just going to do it for you in the middle of the night. When you download it, and you shouldn't download it because there are other protections in there as well, there's a new feature in there. You go to settings, and then you go to battery, and then battery health. And that shows two different factors about your phone that you can measure and decide what to do next. One is peak performance capability. And usually that'll say, no, your phone and the battery are doing as well as they possibly can. But the other one is maximum capacity. How much of the original storage your battery will allow to recharge. I just checked mine while researching this. It's 86%. That's okay, but it's not great. Anything at 80% or under, though, you might want to look at making some moves otherwise.
Well, just asking for a friend, what if it's under 80%?
Right, anyone who has an iPhone 5. If it's close, you may want to replace the battery. And if the phone is still under warranty or you've purchased Apple Care Plus, it may be free to do so. Otherwise, Apple is running a special feature to try to placate people who are upset about this condition. The battery, I think, normally costs about $79 to replace, but it's only $29 if you do it before December 31st of 2018. You can bring it to an Apple store to have it done, or you can send it in. Now, this is going to be hard for a lot of people, especially the younger you are, the more difficult this is going to be, and it's going to sound horrible to certain types of people. Kate, to have this done, it's relatively inexpensive, $29, but you have to give up your phone for 3 to 5 business days.
Ouch. That
yes.
hurts, right?
That's just right. I don't know how certain people are going to do it. Maybe you can carve a block of soap and paint it black and carry that around with you and talk into it and be on it all the time until your actual phone is returned to you.
Buy a flock of pigeons, right? Let's go to Tony, who's been waiting so patiently in Madison. Let's really quickly, Tony.
Yes, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Kate, Kevin. Thank you for what you guys do. I appreciate it. I purchased my first home in December 2010, and I got it through a FHA loan, and I was able to put somewhere from 3 to 5% down, and I just looked at my mortgage statement and seen that there was a FHA MPI, like a FHA insurance policy, and I looked it up, and it said something about if you purchased your home before 2013, you're able to cancel that. And I was hoping that I could cancel that to put that on my principal. Do you know if that's something that I can do, and how do I do that?
So you're talking about PMI, private mortgage insurance, right?
Yeah, it said a FHA MPI, like a FHA insurance policy loan. It was something when I read, it's something about like it protects the lender for giving me the loan since it was through a FHA loan. And I thought I read something like after 5 years, if you had purchased it, your home before 2013, and you're able to put 3-5%, that you can maybe cancel it. Otherwise, it stays with the mortgage the entire time unless you refinance. And I'm not looking to refinance at the moment.
No, just call the lender and ask up. And lenders, typically, they like that PMI because it protects them if you should default on the mortgage. So call them up and see if the current status of both your mortgage and the value of the property, the equity that you may have accumulated in it, is enough to allow you to cancel the private mortgage insurance. And if they say yes, they usually have a procedure to do so. It involves writing a letter to it. It might take you a month or two to get it done. But definitely call them up because that's a good way to save some money.
Tony, thanks so much. And Kevin, what's the website of the week?
It's one of our favorites, consumerfinance.gov. This is the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, and it's a government website, and they do some things which are pretty neat once in a while, where they have online email courses that you can enroll on for free. There's no obligation to it. And they're doing one right now that's starting in this month. It's called Get a Handle on Debt Bootcamp. 21-day course. It's designed to help you set financial goals, handle money emergencies, cut down on stress from mounting bills, and build your finances to where you want to be. We'll have a link to that website at consumerfinance.gov and our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Spend less, have more. Kevin McKinley.